This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. Tonight, the New South Wales Premier cancels daily COVID news conferences, just as the outbreak is set to get worse. The US President's mandating vaccination for all federal workers. Should Australia follow suit with public servants? And 20 years since the September 11 terrorist attacks, my guest is the former Australian ambassador to the United States, who was opposition leader at the time, Kim Beazley.
It was a sickening shock. It winded American society and it winded us as well. It was not anything that anyone had anticipated, at least anyone outside anyone's intelligence services. And it was clear that the world had changed. How it had changed, we wouldn't really know until the dust had settled.
As the New South Wales health system enters what appears to be the most challenging chapter of its battle against the virus, many were surprised by an announcement from the Premier today. Gladys Berejiklian says her government will no longer hold daily press conferences. Critics say she and her ministers are going into hiding just when accountability is needed most. With the state having another record day of new cases and questions lingering about whether the state's chief health officer fully supports the plan to reopen once the 70% double dose mark is reached. Alexia Atwood reports.
Good morning, everybody.
In an uncertain world, the daily 11am news conference is one thing New South Wales residents could rely on. Until now. For the reporters attending, the imminent scrapping of the appointment at this critical phase of the outbreak is an affront to the idea of open and accountable democracy.
We're going to see hospitals come under the greatest stress they've ever seen. And you and your ministers are about to disappear off camera and cancel this press conference. Are you going into hiding? Why on earth that decision?
Instead, a video link will be released every day with health officials presenting the latest information. And the Health Minister and Premier, Gladys Berejiklian, will only call news conferences when they have something to share.
Can I just say very, very clearly and loudly to the people of New South Wales, we will be here whenever we need to communicate something very importantly
like
to the community.
We're getting a video message.
I will make sure that we are, but what we also need to do is all of us have to start accepting that we need to live with COVID.
COVID cases are set to peak next week, up from 1,542, the most recent count of new daily infections. And over the coming weeks, the pressure on the hospitals is going to hit an all-time high.
Shouldn't you hold these press conferences until after the peak has passed?
Well, we will never know when that is.
The state's going ahead with a plan to ease some restrictions when 70% of the eligible population have had two doses of a COVID vaccine, with new liberties only afforded to the people who have proof of vaccination. The government's facing repeated questions over reports that the state's chief health officer, Dr. Kerry Chant, wasn't too keen on restrictions easing at that 70% vaccination rate. After this exchange between a reporter and the Deputy Premier, John Barilaro, it's not any clearer what truth there is to that reporting.
There are reports that Dr. Chant said that she would only be comfortable with the roadmap kicking in from 80 to 85%. Is that true?
Well, can I say, I prepared the roadmap, I brought the roadmap to the crisis committee, I had the endorsement of health, including Dr. Kerry Chant. I'll put it this way, you know, health, if they could, they would love to see more vaccinations, keep the place locked down. But we've got to find a balance. We've got to keep people on the journey. And with the Doherty Institute work, with the roadmap, the federal roadmap and the agreement of the chief ministers and the premiers, we were able to develop a roadmap that is endorsed and supported by New South Wales Health, and that is the roadmap we have released.
No matter who supported what, the New South Wales roadmap has now been made public and will be actioned. But could the timing get messy? Hospitals are set to be at their busiest just as people start pouring back into pubs. Nancy Baxter is head of the School of Population and Global Health at Melbourne University. She says that unbridled promise to reopen the Monday after we hit that 70% double dose vaccination rate, no matter what, is too risky.
Just setting kind of a plan that we're going to kind of open up when we're 70% and not taking into account what's happening on the ground in terms of ICU, you know, that's kind of not so much of a roadmap. That's so much of a train crash, potentially.
Angela Webster is Professor of Clinical Epidemiology at the University of Sydney and a Senior Staff Specialist at Westmead Hospital, one of Sydney's worst hit. She says people will still be cautious when things open up because case numbers won't have fallen. But here's where we'll need to make that crucial psychological shift to focus on hospitalisation rates as opposed to case numbers.
That's the shift that's happened overseas, and we're just a little bit, because we haven't had an outbreak like this before, we haven't quite made that psychological shift because we haven't all had access to vaccination until recently. Only a small proportion of us have been vaccinated. So I think that's the shift that will happen.
Professor Rainer McIntyre is head of the Biosecurity Research Program at the Kirby Institute at the University of New South Wales. She thinks that once New South Wales opens up, things could take a turn for the worse by Christmas.
You know, we've done some modelling to look at what will happen under different scenarios of lifting restrictions, and the timing of it is such that we're going to be facing a surge over Christmas and New Year, probably. You know, if we start relaxing restrictions in October, November, what we're going to see is that the cases soaring up again towards Christmas, unless we really focus on every possible way we can mitigate transmission, and that includes ventilation. New South Wales hasn't addressed that systematically across the board. It is the most important way the virus spreads, through the air you breathe.
Professor Rainer McIntyre from the Kirby Institute at the University of New South Wales, Alexia Atwood reporting. The enormous stress on the New South Wales health system can be measured in many ways. One of them is how the number of ambulance call-outs has soared in the last fortnight. Paramedics are under intense pressure and worried about what lies in store for them in October. The state's ambulance commissioner, Dominic Morgan, says extra personnel are being brought in to bolster the system. David Sparks has more.
As the COVID numbers rise in New South Wales, so does the pressure on ambulance crews. Tess Oxley is a paramedic stationed in southwest Sydney and a delegate for the Health Services Union.
That pressure is knowing that you've had jobs outstanding for over 12 hours. That's patients waiting for ambulances for over 12 hours. It's being delayed at hospitals for 4 or 5 hours at a time. This week I had to do a 17-hour shift and drive home at 10 to 1 in the morning. All of this on top of then having to make clinical decisions that are still relatively new to us with the different types of strains of COVID and the new things that we are facing.
So in a typical day at the moment, or let's say a typical week, say the last week, how many COVID-related call-outs would a paramedic have?
I work out of Campbelltown Station in southwest Sydney. I tend to be doing probably between 2 and 4 COVID patients each shift, and I'd be probably doing 7 to 8 patients in a shift. Out in Western Sydney and in some of the higher dense areas in southwest Sydney, nearly all of their patients will be COVID positive patients.
And paramedics are doing all of this in thick plastic gowns, masks and goggles. The New South Wales Ambulance Commissioner, Dominic Morgan, today acknowledged this incredible workload. He says 2 weeks ago, the state's ambulance had transported 2,500 COVID patients in the previous 2 months. But in just the past 2 weeks, they've transported 5,900. At the press conference, he was asked this question about delays at hospitals.
How frustrating is it for you to watch your colleagues, your members, lining up for sometimes hours outside of hospitals as that bottleneck happens in emergency departments trying to get COVID patients into hospitals? And secondly, is there a chance we're going to see people dying as they wait in ambulances, or indeed they can't get into ambulances because there's so many of them trapped at hospitals in queues?
The critical thing that I would say to that is I know that every doctor, every nurse and every paramedic in this state is doing the best they can to look after their patients. So the fact is, it's a reality that they have to be super cautious when dealing with patients who potentially will contaminate them and other patients in the hospital. And it does take a long time. We do know that some weeks ago there were some significant delays that were being experienced right across the board. And that was largely due to the need to adapt and change models of care. We've seen a lot of improvement in that area, but there is absolutely no doubt there are still long, extensive delays.
Dominic Morgan is promising to boost staff levels. He says 60 interns start tomorrow, which means there'll be an extra 20 ambulances on the roads, and more recruits are on the way. But paramedic Tess Oxley says this is a problem that began long before COVID.
I think it's a fault of a system that's been neglected for over a decade. We are having increased calls at the moment due to the pandemic, but we're also facing increased just normal calls, and we've been facing those increased calls for a long time now. And I think we have to stop saying that there's an early flu season or there's an abnormally hot summer or there's bushfires. The fact is the population has increased, the need for ambulance and paramedic responses has increased, and we have not increased with that demand.
Other parts of the health system are also under pressure, especially hospitals. Surgeries have been delayed, and that's taking an emotional toll on patients. Elizabeth Pickworth has been fighting thymus cancer since late 2018. She's already been through surgery and chemotherapy. Now she's waiting for more vital surgery, ideally in the next month, but she's got no idea when it will happen.
So I am a public patient, and my surgeon informed me, and also following the news, that public ICU beds are actually overtaken by COVID patients. So that it's very unlikely that I would be able to have the surgery in the public hospital as a public patient. So he's doing what he can to see if he can get me in the private hospital. And he said he's done it before with another patient recently. But given the fact that I'm sure that there are many other people, you know, in my position that do require life-saving surgery, I just don't know how many, you know, favours hospital administrators can do.
That's cancer patient Elizabeth Pickworth, ending that report by David Sparks and David Taylor. Faced with a slowing vaccine uptake and the unrelenting wave of the Delta variant, the US President Joe Biden is introducing new far-reaching COVID vaccine mandates. The rules apply to federal workers, large employers and healthcare staff. That's nearly 100 million Americans. Here in Australia, though, the Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, has ruled out imposing public health orders that would mandate vaccines, leaving the states and private businesses to decide for themselves. As Bridget Fitzgerald reports.
With 160,000 cases of COVID-19 a day, US President Joe Biden has had enough.
My message to unvaccinated Americans is this: what more is there to wait for? What more do you need to see? We've made vaccinations free, safe, and convenient. The vaccine is FDA approval. Over 200 million Americans have gotten at least one shot. We've been patient, but our patience is wearing thin, and your refusal has cost all of us.
The new vaccine mandate will require employers with more than 100 workers to ensure their employees are either vaccinated or tested weekly. The same rule applies to workers at health facilities that receive federal, Medicare or Medicaid. A separate executive order will also require federal employees and contractors to be fully vaccinated. Just 42% of the US population is fully vaccinated, and 51% have had just one dose.
This is a pandemic of the unvaccinated, and it's caused by the fact that despite America having unprecedented and successful vaccination program, despite the fact that for almost 5 months, free vaccines have been available in 80,000 different locations, we still have nearly 80 million Americans who have failed to get the shot.
Responses have been varied. The National Treasury Employees Union, which represents 150,000 federal workers, said in a statement the government has the legal right to require employees to be immunised, while Republican National Committee Chairwoman Ronna McDaniel announced the RNC intends to sue the president over the mandate, labelling it unconstitutional and an imposition on business. The president, however, says something needs to be done to combat the highly contagious wave of the Delta variant sweeping the nation, which is overwhelmingly affecting the unvaccinated. And if you're wondering if the federal government here in Australia might look to introduce a vaccine mandate, the answer is no. Prime Minister Scott Morrison has ruled it out.
The vaccination program in Australia is free and it is not mandatory. That is a very important principle. We are not going to seek to impose a mandatory vaccination program by the government by stealth. That is not what we're going to do. It is a non-mandatory program.
Dr. Giuseppe Carabetta, a senior lecturer in employment law at the University of Sydney, says what that means is there's a far more haphazard approach to mandates across the country as state governments try and fill in the gaps.
Because the federal government has taken the philosophical view that it doesn't want to mandate, a number of the states, so New South Wales, Queensland, WA, South Australia, and I think Tasmania, they have in pocket areas, in critical, essential areas, like airports in New South Wales, health now in New South Wales, but only recently, health in Queensland, quarantine in WA, et cetera, these high risk sectors, the states have passed public health orders, but they are limited.
And without a federal government mandate in the form of a public health order, private companies are essentially taking on the risk of the mandates they impose being challenged by their employees.
Big organisations like SBC or Qantas, somebody may decide for whatever reason to challenge. If they do challenge, the issue we've got there from a commercial perspective is that the tribunal or the court will only decide the issue, namely, whether their policy is reasonable or not, on the particular facts before them. So it's going to take some time before we get serious guidance. And this is a nice loop back to your earlier point about why companies like Qantas have been metaphorically screaming for the government to mandate, because they did not want for them to hold this hot potato.
Dr. Giuseppe Carabetta from the University of Sydney, ending Bridget Fitzgerald's report. You're listening to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. Ahead, Indigenous rangers battle to keep foreign fishing nets that kill tropical marine animals out of their waters.
Mean ones, the turtles getting caught up at the golf nets and dying, getting washed up on the beach.
Tomorrow is the 20th anniversary of the September 11 terror attacks, the deadliest acts of modern terror ever committed. Nearly 3,000 people were killed when al-Qaeda terrorists flew planes into New York's World Trade Center and the Pentagon, and the hijacked Flight 93 crashed into a field in Pennsylvania. 11 Australians were among the dead. On the evening of the 12th of September, Australian time, the late Mark Colvin was hosting PM. Here's how we reported the atrocities.
Good evening and welcome to PM. I'm Mark Colvin. Like Pearl Harbor, it's a day that will live in infamy. Like Pearl Harbor, America is interpreting it as an act of war. Like Pearl Harbor, massive retaliation is the first thing on Washington's mind.
Mayor Rudolph Giuliani says people should still hold out hope. He says they should have no misconceptions about the devastating size of the death toll.
I know that there's great concern over what the numbers of people lost are. We don't know the answer to that. The dimension will be very large. In terms of the people we're looking for, it's a couple of hundred firefighters and police officers, which is a staggering number.
To our correspondent Michael Carey on the streets of New York.
Across the road directly in front of me, there's about a 20-metre high wall, which until, a few hours ago was a financial district building. This is, of course, I'm on the outskirts of the richest financial centre in the United States, the richest probably in the world, and instead it's just dust, filth, and lots of sirens, lots and lots of emergency work.
But American fingers keep pointing more and more strongly towards one man, Osama bin Laden, and one country, Afghanistan. Our correspondent, Jonathan Harley, is in the Afghan capital, Kabul.
Shadowy, I guess, is the most common adjective which goes with Osama bin Laden. It is believed that he is based, well, it is understood he's based around the southern city of Kandahar, which is the Taliban stronghold. But because he is not in the public view, no one can be sure, though it's unlikely that anybody would be interested in having him. He is protected by the Taliban, partly because he is Washington's public enemy number one, and he is unwanted by just about any other discerning administration in the world.
Kim Beazley is the Governor of Western Australia, and he was Australia's ambassador to the United States from 2010 to 2016. But back in 2001, he was the Labor opposition leader, and he spoke to PM soon after getting a briefing on the attacks from the government.
It's an act of war. Firstly, the evidence has to be established off course, and the United States is going about that process now quite clearly beginning to discover things as it does so. When they have proof, then they will act, and we would support that action. I think it's important in this environment to be calm, to be focused, to be directed towards getting at those who are responsible for it. We need a united community. They want it in the United States. We need it here. We need to understand, for example, in Australia, that all Australians share horror at this, be they Christians, be they Muslims, be they Jewish Australians, Hindu, Buddhist, no religious affiliation. We are united in our horror at what has happened here.
Kim Beazley, you were speaking there at the end of a very long day in Australia. It was the 12th of September by then, of course. What do you remember of that day?
Well, I'm glad to have heard that comment that I made back then, because it brings it back to me enormously vividly. It was a sickening shock that really it winded American society, and it winded us as well. It was not anything that anyone had anticipated, at least anyone outside anyone's intelligence services. And it was clear that the world had changed. How it had changed, we wouldn't really know until the dust had settled, literally. But after that, things were going to be different. And as it happened, a very close friend of a member of my staff had been in the centre, and as time went by, it became clear that he was dead. That actually personalised it for me and personalised it for those in my office.
And how did the relationship between the United States and Australia change from that date?
Well, we were fortunate, actually, to have John Howard in the United States at the time, so that he was able to convey to the Americans pretty quickly the fact that we were in solidarity and that we regarded ANZUS as having been effectively activated, and that we would be going into whatever conflict the Americans were going to go into as a result of it. It's made a big difference to the, if you like, the potency of the intelligence collaboration that we have with the United States. It's been a major, not necessarily dominant issue now, in the Five Eyes intelligence exchanges. We have a very sophisticated approach to the development of counter-terrorist information and counter-terrorist capabilities. We're much more capable and alert people than we were then. I think in a way it probably made us a bit closer with the US.
Given the recent events in Afghanistan, there's been a lot of reviewing and assessment of how the war on terror, as it was called, or is called, has been handled. What's your assessment of that over the last couple of decades?
Well, it's been pretty effective. There have been, there will be more terrorist attacks as time goes by. We experienced very shortly afterwards several attacks on our people in Indonesia, and that cemented a much stronger collaboration between Australia and the Indonesians. I think we became a more knowing and sophisticated set of operators, knowing in terms of where and how threats might emerge.
For a lot of younger people, they don't remember September the 11th, 2001. If they were to ask you why is it important to remember that day, what would you say?
That you need to remember what could happen, and that what happened happened really to ordinary people. This was a tragedy for ordinary people. This was not an attack on a military base. This was an attack on two public buildings. And the people who died in such large numbers or people who, for whom the idea of combat would never enter their minds. And that in democratic politics, when that's out there in the ether, you have to take note, and they'd be wise to read up the history.
What do you think was the legacy for Australians in terms of the changes to their everyday life and perhaps their psyche?
Well, I think it did make us a warier people. And you can see that every time you go to an airport. You go through security procedures, which when I was a boy, we would not have even contemplated for a day.
So 20 years on, is that the main legacy of September the 11th, do you think?
I hope that part of the legacy of the events of that day is that we sustain an international consciousness, a concern for our friends and allies, a concern for all elements of our public, that they all feel bound into the community and the state. But the other legacy is watchfulness. We're a much more knowing people.
Kim Beazley, who was the Federal Opposition Leader back in 2001, reflecting there on the legacy of the September 11 attacks. The federal government is joining Indigenous ranger groups and commercial fishermen to develop a new system to recover abandoned foreign fishing nets more efficiently and cheaply. Thousands of turtles, dolphins and sharks in Australia's northern waters get entangled in these so-called walls of death every year. And the CSIRO says the number of problem nets is increasing. Jane Barden reports.
Turquoise waters around the Groote Island archipelago in the Gulf of Carpentaria look pristine.
We head north. It's about that second island there.
But for Amandilyakwa Indigenous Sea Ranger Leighton Hastings, patrols regularly involve depressing work collecting marine rubbish.
Mainly ghost nets, but other marine debris on the beach is all just rubbish, bottles, cans.
The abandoned fishing nets are mostly coming from Indonesia and other Asian countries on ocean currents after being cut off or lost during bad weather and entanglement. Anandilyakwa Ranger Terence Lalara is sad to see their effect on marine life.
Main ones, the turtles getting caught up at the ghost nets and dying, getting washed up on the beach.
CSIRO senior research scientist Denise Hardesty has carried out a study of 16 years of data, which has found the number of nets arriving has quadrupled, particularly in the Gulf of Carpentaria and Torres Strait. She says in some areas that has meant an increase from 60 nets a year to nearly 300 a year.
What we found is that overall we see an increase of ghost nets landing on Australia's shores. This is in spite of the fact that over 10 to 15,000 ghost nets have been removed from the region over the last 15 years.
Peter Van Slovis is the General Manager of Operations at the Australian Fisheries Management Authority in Darwin.
Gill nets, they are known as, can be anywhere between tens of metres up to sometimes over 100 kilometres. We have arrangements in place to contract private suppliers to actually go out and pick these nets up.
The government agencies have developed a new system of attaching GPS beacons to the nets,
so that they can be tracked after the patrol boat leaves the area and we can vector a contract vessel into the right area to pick up the net and they don't have to search around for it.
The federal government has funded the $14 million project for 3 years. But could Australia do more to stop the nets coming? Federal Environment Minister Susan Lee.
Thousands of ghost nets and pieces of discarded fishing gear can be removed from the waters of the Gulf of Carpentaria and the Torres Strait with the funding that we've provided.
Quite a few of these nets are coming from Indonesia and some of our other near Asian neighbours. Is the Australian government doing anything to try and talk to those countries about better fisheries management?
We do have partnerships with Southeast Asia, including Indonesia, where this is discussed, but we can't wait to tackle this at the source.
For Anandilyakwa Ranger Leighton Hastings and his colleagues, the work is personal as they do what they can to keep their precious sea country clean.
Love going out on country, just looking after this place. There's not many places like it left. It just looks so, you know, beautiful. The waters are so blue. Yeah.
Sea Ranger Leighton Hastings talking to Jane Barden on Groote Island. And that's PM for this week. PM's producer is David Cody. Technical production by David Lawford and Scott Johnston. I'm Samantha Donovan. Linda Mottram is along in the morning with This Week, speaking with Pulitzer Prize-winning New York writer Fred Kaplan on 9/11 and how it fuelled American xenophobia.
Hi, I'm Angela Voipierre.
And I'm Stephen Smiley, and we're from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal. The five-day week is such a fixture in most of our lives that few people stop to wonder whether it's really the best way to run things. But from Iceland and Spain to the US and Scotland, that may be starting to change.
Today on The Signal, what does a four-day work week look like? And if paying people the same money to work less really does improve productivity, why isn't everyone doing it? Look for The Signal on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.